Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on, affiliates around New Zealand and whatnot. I'm still getting used to the new format where we're doing a three-hour interview with really great researchers and what have you, without any commercial breaks, and doing it all pre-recorded as well. I think is quite nice. It's very relaxing. And, anyway, getting on to our very special guest today, his name is Kevin Galilee. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you for having me, Vinny, for the second time, I might add. I appreciate the opportunity, and we have a lot to talk about, so I'm not daunted by the prospect of speaking for 3 hours.
Yeah, I didn't think you would be. So you have a number of things that we wanted to get into, discuss, and during the last interview we talked about various methods of global depopulation policy, and it was in fact quite an enlightening sort of like, wow, this guy's actually got an intricate knowledge of the extraordinary levels of scumbaggery in our society and how they actually came about, and from a policy level it seemed like, right? It occurs to me that this is how the depopulation agenda is really being done. All these decisions are being made at the policy level at 30,000 feet, and all the people that implement it down on the ground floor, they have no idea.
Very much so. This is why I thought it necessary in the first interview to present, you know, the historical perspective of this policy, which is the pivotal policy of the international order since the Second World War. So the last time we discussed its causes and its methods, we placed it in historical perspective. We exposed the immoral, unlawful, and the fact that all these methods are covert and not overt. We disclosed to the public the fact that it has been going on since 1945 and not, as it is commonly believed, to be just a new phenomenon. So it is a policy that is in its seventh decade. Today I want to talk about its consequences. We didn't have a chance to cover that during the last interview in November. I also want to show how this policy fits in the grand scheme of things, how it fits in with the plan for global peace and security that was embarked upon at the end of the Second World War and with the formation of the United Nations. And I want to show how that it, in fact, the depopulation policy is inseparable from globalization, and it is actually the underbelly of globalization, if you want to put it that way.
One and the same, like strands of DNA intertwining.
Yes, because the goals of attaining global peace and security, which goes by the name of globalization nowadays, cannot be accomplished without the depopulation policy. And I will sort of elucidate on that as we go along. But to start with, I'm going to go straight to the middle of my book, where I have presented or outlined a short list of what this policy has cost us in human life so far.
But before you do that, can you please just give the name of your book and where the listeners might be able to purchase a copy?
Yes. The name of the book is Killing Us Softly: Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy. It is available online by simply Googling my name, Kevin Galilei, and Killing Us Softly. It is available in at least four or five different places. And it will be published, unless the censors interfere, it will be published by Progressive Press this year, in 2015. We shall see if that happens or not. In any case, I will always make my book available for free to those who cannot afford to buy it, for the simple reason that the subject is far too important to everyone's survival, and it should not be subject to whether one has the money or not.
Well, by all means, proceed.
Okay, so the short list I've split into three sections. One, the cost so far in human life. Two, what exactly has been averted by introducing and by carrying out this policy. And three, what will happen if this policy continues in this form with the current methodology. So I'm going to follow this list so we go through it quickly, and then we'll settle on the details of the direct, indirect, and unintended consequences. Now, for one thing, 2 billion birds have been covertly prevented by chemical, biological, and bacteriological means. The magnitude of this policy is unbelievable. Now, 2 billion birds covertly prevented. In addition to that, approximately 500 million birds have been overtly prevented through legislation and abortion. And these mainly in China. 400 million of these birds have been prevented in China through their one-child policy. More than 300 million genetic lines, primarily in the developed world and primarily in the West, have been permanently and irrevocably shut out of procreation. Japan, Europe, Russia, North America, Australia, New Zealand, in other words, all of the OECD countries, all of the developed countries, in all of these countries, the IQ, the intelligence quotient, has been downgraded by approximately 15 points across the population. Now, in individual cases, by far more. And in certain brackets or sections of low socioeconomic income, even more so. About 10 to 15% of the population has been covertly chemically sterilized, and has been rendered sexually confused through chemical sterilization. This is one of the side effects, if you want, of prolonged chemical sterilization or chemical fertility depressing agents such as fluoride and BPA. If someone has been exposed, if a genetic line has been exposed over multiple generations. Most importantly, about 20 to 25% of all children born in countries subject to covert chemical sterilization methods have been condemned to developmental disorders. One out of five Western women have been rendered infertile or childless by a combination of chemical and psychosocial methods of population control. Compare that to one out of 20 in China and only one out of 30 in India. And you get an idea of how huge this discrepancy is.
It's funny we should be talking about this, because I didn't recall what we were going to be speaking about, but in the back of my mind this morning was Planned Parenthood being responsible for 80 million abortions, and was it Madame Blavatsky or Margaret Sanger who was quoted as saying, "We need to ensure that the blacks don't realize that we're just trying to exterminate them."
Yeah, well, at that time, the eugenic component was far stronger than it is today. I must say that in the meantime, that they have sort of cleaned up their act somewhat in this respect, which is not to say that that blacks in the United States are not subjected, you know, to these methods to a greater extent than whites. But that doesn't have so much to do with their color as it has to do with the socioeconomic standing. To move on, another thing that came to my mind as you mentioned that you had forgotten what we were going to talk about is that you're flying by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, totally.
And so am I because I never have any chance to prepare in great detail for either the interviews or I never have any chance to write in at a leisurely pace. I'm so overworked and so
my preparation for interviews is restricted to making sure I eat something and make myself a cup of coffee.
I had my coffee prior to this.
Yeah,
but to continue with this grotesque list. 100% of the population subjected to chemical, biological fertility control methods have damaged endocrine systems, which result in chronic illness in at least 25% of these affected populations. And this is why we see, you know, all of these so-called illnesses of affluence. They are the result of this damage done to the endocrine system. All males subjected to chemical fertility control methods have compromised substandard sperm. So they're either completely infertile or subfertile. More than...
You know, it's interesting you should say that because I do meet a lot of people who oppose who I am and what I do, who I just... It occurs to me, you must have been conceived with a substandard sperm bank.
We're making light of this, but when you think about it, you know, just the helplessness our helplessness as a people is extraordinary because we are at the receiving end of a policy that has been going on for 7 decades. Now we could very well be the third or even the fourth generation exposed to these methods, right? So we have no conception of what it is even like to lead a life without being surrounded or bombarded by these poisons in our life that have been deliberately introduced, you know, for these demographic objectives and geopolitical objectives. The last item on my list is that more than 500 million people, that's half a billion people, have met with premature death due to artificially high levels of morbidity and mortality that have been achieved, you know, primarily by the introduction of the HIV virus in the population, but as well also as a result of the illness that is caused by these chemical biological agents. Now, this is the price that we have paid as a society. If you want, this is the price that we have paid for our affluence in the West. What has been averted, however, because had there not been a good reason to reach out to such desperate measures of population control, had there been not a good reason, this would have never happened. I cannot even begin to imagine how difficult it would have been to reach any kind of consensus, even behind closed doors, even among, you know, elites who are well informed and who have access to information and to all kinds of predictions as to where society is heading if we do nothing about it, if they do nothing about it, because really we are just victims. But as I have described, we are victims in a sense, but we are beneficiaries in another sense. What has been averted? And this is the short list of what has been averted. Well, had they not started with population control in 1945, civilization would have long collapsed because we could have never been able to support an additional 2 billion people an additional 2 billion people would have been born into the world between 1950 and now. So instead of 7 billion, we would have 9 billion by now. There's no way that our food production and our technology to produce food, our green revolution, would not have been able to compensate or to feed these additional 2 billion people. But we would have not even started on the long and arduous process of the demographic transition. That is to say, we would not have started to interfere with this growth, this natural population growth, which is, you know, which is like a pyramid. It's represented graphically like a pyramid with the very very old at the top, the very young at the bottom, and this pyramid of population growth, it just broadens and broadens and broadens. It doubles every 30 or 40 years, depending on sort of sexual mores and on the culture. So we would have not even begun to interfere with our fertility and to reduce the population growth, which is a process that takes anywhere from 3 to 5 generations. So by now, if they had waited until today, when the population is 7 billion, even if they would have started, you know, in the most extreme way to reduce fertility or and to increase mortality, it would have been too little, too late. Widespread famine would have destabilized Africa, South America, and Asia by the 1980s, causing universal misery and suffering of an order of magnitude that we have never experienced. There would have been billions of people starving to death. A Western world with a population twice as large as it is today. Let's say we have approximately 800 million people, 800 million whites between North America, Europe, New Zealand, Australia, you know, some in South America and so on. We would have been twice as many. Now, consider that whites or Westerners consume infinitely more resources due to our standard of living and our advanced technological society than people in the developing world. Already, with 800 million people, we consume over half of the world's resources. 800 million people today consume over half of the world's resources. That means that the remaining 6.2 billion people have to make do with the remaining 50% of the world's resources.
Well, part of that is the fact that manufacturers and consumerism kind of ideology has made them make everything with planned obsolescence. I mean, if things were built to last, I doubt that 800 million people would be consuming 90% of the resources because most of those resources are simply wasted.
Yes, I will divert here a little bit from my list to address that point. The built-in obsolescence in our manufactured goods. And that came to be in order to keep people employed. You see, if they would have continued with manufacturing goods that last, you know, forever, or that last for a generation or two, there would have been that much less employment. So, of course, this is not does not fit in with a capitalist system where you have to create things, you have to manufacture things in order to create profit, and that profit turns into capital that can in turn be invested to create more things and to get even more capital. So to increase wealth in a capitalist society, you have to produce things. And that is why this built-in obsolescence has been introduced sometimes.
Do you think that maybe it's stifled human creativity somewhat by getting everybody to work a job making stuff that doesn't last and doesn't matter, rather than actually having time to think, time to create, time to pioneer?
Well, this has been really the result of dire situation of circumstances of the desperation of governments to keep people employed, you know, an ever-growing population, everybody looking for work. And once this population spilled out of the countryside and could no longer be employed, you know, on farms and in agriculture, and started invading the cities, which is what happened in England at the end of the 19th century, which is why London's population exploded and you had this this terrible poverty because there was absolutely no system of social welfare to accommodate these people. It was something completely new, a complete reversal or disruption of the balance of society, where before in agrarian times or pre-industrial times, the population was overwhelmingly 90% of it was employed in agriculture on the farms.
Not to mention on these farms and everything, they had something that that doesn't exist in cities, a sense of community.
Yes, well, there's no doubt that society was altered in cultural ways to a completely unrecognizable form, and that process continues because we're no longer an agrarian society or a rural society. We're now an industrial society and an urban society. 80% of Westerners live in cities; they don't live in the countryside anymore.
And this reminds me of back in the 30s, I believe it was during the Great Depression. A statistic that I heard that during that depression, 10 million Americans starved to death. That's back during that population era. I'm not sure how many people there were living in the United States at that time. And at that time, 90% of people lived in rural areas and grew their own food. That and 10 million people still starve to death. Today, as you say, 80% of people live in urban areas and don't grow their own food. So you could imagine what a depression would do, how massive the population would be reduced by simply through starvation.
This is a very good point you make, and one that I've addressed in one of my articles in a series called Survival or Extinction. And which is why governments now are in such a desperate mode, if you want. They realize that in a modern society, people have no food independence. They're completely reliant on income. And you cannot have an income without a job. So this chronic unemployment that has developed due to the modernization of our manufacturing processes, where you know everything is digitized and mechanized and computerized, it's eliminating more and more jobs, and it is becoming impossible for governments to employ people. So unemployment has become chronic. But chronic unemployment in a fully monetized economy spells disaster. Why? Because without an income, you cannot survive. You cannot feed yourself and your family. It is not as though in the past, you know, you had a patch of land, a few acres, and you can plant, you know, just enough food so you can practice subsistence farming, which is still the case in the developing world in many countries. Now all of us are completely dependent on the ability of society, of modern agriculture, to make food, you know, cheap and universally available. But we're losing the ability to buy this food, even though it is cheap and universally available in the West and abundant, right? Because we don't have jobs. We don't have jobs because of modern society. So it is a circle that we you know, a cycle now that we cannot escape, and nobody knows how to solve it.
I think education plays a big part in this, because I think the modern education system was brought about in order to meet the needs of industrialism in the first place. So they were breeding basically human beings that had had their sense of creativity and entrepreneurship disabled so that they could be more readily utilized into the workforce, follow orders blindly, and be much, much more easy to control for employers. And I think that this is the very reason why people have become in such a state of crisis, because everything that is part of the human faculty to solve crisis, to create solutions, has been destroyed deliberately by the establishment in order to support itself.
I would go even further and say that before there was a deliberate attempt, you know, to engineer the social outcome, we became victims of circumstances, if you want. Why? I've just explained how we lost the ability to be independent in the manner in which we grow food. And I explained how we became dependent on an industrial society to supply us with jobs so that we can buy the food produced through industrial means and no longer on family farms. So we having lost that independence, we have become more enfeebled, if you want. And governments were looking, you know, for solutions, and they had absolutely no roadmap to follow, because humanity has never been in this situation. We encountered this transition now from an agrarian society to a industrial society, and now from an industrial society to a post-industrial society. We're going blindly. There is no roadmap to follow. There are no textbooks to follow. Nobody really knows how to solve these problems. So we solve them as we go along. And of course, the political process now has become completely inadequate, because we are working with national institutions in an international world order. And these national institutions are completely inadequate and inept in solving these international problems. That's why globalization is now proceeding at a desperate pace, in order to build this political and institutional infrastructure necessary to solve today's problems. Unprecedented problems.
Well, you're right. And what occurred to me as you were speaking was that they've managed to identify that the crisis, more or less, is a lack of individual personal responsibility, creativity, that kind of thing. These things have been systematically destroyed in favor of blind faith in authoritarian figures. And I think, what was the other element that I was going to say here? Blind faith and collectivism. Collectivism is ultimately the massive problem here, because people expect everybody else to solve their problems. Had the elite and what have you structured a society whereby each and every individual was empowered to solve problems, take personal responsibility, be creative and what have you, I would be surprised if our current society wasn't a hell of a lot better off in the short term and in the long term. However, because they have failed in their attempt to fully collectivize and support society at the same time, their answer is to collectivize it even further, to the point where individual responsibility and creativity doesn't exist anymore at all to oppose their system. I think the word is insane.
What you are describing, in a sense, are also the effects of a modern society and of a modern economy. We are so compartmentalized now in our duties and functions, and therefore so completely dependent on others doing a million other functions. We become so super specialized, that unless the system works smoothly, our dependence now on one another is so great, and our inability to be independent is so great, that we can no longer even envision, a return to the good old days. It's just simply not possible. This is really a function of a modern, technically and scientifically advanced society. I mean, the bank of knowledge, the quantity of knowledge that is inherent in modern society is so huge that a single person can no longer acquire that. Mm. Up to about the 15th, 16th century, you still had the concept of the so-called uomo universale, the universal man. An intellectual like Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo and so on, who were very intelligent and who acquired knowledge from every field of knowledge at that time, and they could just about barely encompass all of human knowledge within one human brain. That is no longer possible today. Knowledge has grown exponentially. And therefore, specialization has grown exponentially, because there's just too much to know, too many processes, and society has become too complex. And now we are dependent on one another. Mm. We can no longer even hope to have independence. If, let's say, we were to return to the farm, which is possible, and some people do, they return to the farm, but in no time at all, they find out that life on the farm and being independent is very, very difficult, and that the standard of living is nowhere near, what one can have by being part of this this modern complex society and fulfilling just one small role in this huge complex that civilization has become.
Oh, you're right. And I had the privilege of talking with a guy who calls himself Thunder. He's a quantum mechanics physicist and what have you. And he grew up on a farm in Iowa, and some of the technology that his father and his family pioneered on that farm would actually be really, really good in terms of use today, and it was quite advanced for its time. But the problem is people just don't seem to catch on. And we're talking about independence here and how there's X amount of unfathomable, huge, giant knowledge that specialists will take sections of it, and that's how society runs. Mm-hmm. There's basics, though. For example, my soon-to-be wife, Sarah, she was taught by her parents in South Africa how to sew, mend clothing and make clothing by her mother, and how to grow food and how to construct simple things, right? And just those very, very simple things about how to clothe yourself, how to feed yourself, and how to provide a shelter for yourself is not taught almost at all anymore. And those are very basic skills that can save your life. And they're not that hard to learn, nor do they take an exorbitant amount of time. And you can specialize in anything else after you've got your basics right, I think.
We are so divorced from the land now, so removed from the land and from a life on the farm, that many of us, even though they might have the interest or the will, they don't have the opportunity. First of all, they live, you know, in these mega cities, completely surrounded by the concrete jungle. And the prospect of spending time on the farm is almost a dream. I am one of perhaps the last generation to have benefited, you know, from that kind of an education, and only because my father was a farm boy. Even though he was a medical doctor, he was he never lost the love of the land, and he put together, you know, a kind of like a city farm, and we had animals, and we had a huge garden, and he made me, dig in the ground and plant and grow and, you know, clean up after the animals, and taught me about animal
husbandry
and about agriculture. So, and I still have that knowledge, but of course I'm not applying it because I don't have the land. If I had the land, and I'm hoping that one day I will have a patch of land, I would love to, you know, to put those skills to good use. But most of the population in the Western world, which is, as I said, 80% urban, never has a chance to learn even the basics.
Well, I did see an incredible article in Japan where they have zero land. Zero. They've created a culture. There's actually a subset culture whereby growing food indoors out of even just little aluminium cans and what have you, where they actually turn it into an art thing. So you'll grow herbs all around your house, all different types of herbs and little cans, pretty much everywhere where there's a window sill or a light or anything like that. Some people use bookshelves that are lined with the food and what have you being produced, and they would even decorate and paint all of these cans and what have you. So the ability for people to come up with creative ways of using land, I think, is quite beautiful. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't have enough land to grow enough food, there ain't going to be any way that people can survive. And it's just that simple, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
Well, this is why the depopulation policy came to be. We've simply reached the limits of our ability to grow food and feed all the people that are being born into the world. And that was, you know, foreseen as early as 1945. Of course, famine is not something that we've experienced just in the modern era. I mean, this has been a struggle throughout history. And there are innumerable examples when conflict has resulted because of a lack of food, and famines have killed thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people throughout history. Now it's just the dimension of the problem that is greater than ever before. Of course, we have, you know, at our disposal more technological fixes and tools than ever before. But also, we have reached the ends of our natural resources, and we have overstretched everything. So, you know, this realization was made in 1945, and thank goodness somebody did. And that's how the global depopulation policy came to be. This consensus was easily made because, you know, people saw the writing on the wall. The experts saw the writing on the wall, and they realized if they don't do something about it, we're all going to be doomed.
I recall a story. There was a mathematician and a king, and the king wanted something from the mathematician, a formula or something of that nature. And the king asked the mathematician, "How do you want to be paid?" And he says, "I want you to pay me in grain." And he grabbed a chessboard, and he said he placed one grain on the first square and two grains on the second square. And he says, "I want you to double every single time the next square comes up." So the third square would be four grain, and the next square after that would be eight grain. And the king laughed at him, and he said, "This is easy. This is no problem. This is going to be a piece of cake. I can pay you that with my chump change in my pocket." Little did he know that mathematical exponentialism through that kind of doubling process meant that he actually wound up bankrupting himself trying to pay that mathematician, because he was unable to even provide any payment of any kind anywhere near sufficient in order to pay what the mathematician's fee was. And this, I think, is an important lesson when we talk about population growth or anything that's growing, is that it can soon go out of control.
Yes, population growth, you know, can uninterfered population growth, natural population growth is exponential. In the old days, prior to the Second World War, most families had four children or more, and most of these children survived. Of course, so the potential for a doubling of the population every 20, 30 years is always there in a population that has natural growth. And, of course, the ability to grow food, to increase food production at the same rate, at the same exponential rate as the population growth, is impossible. And that is why, throughout history, we have outgrown our food supplies and run into trouble. And it was only at the end of the Second World War, after having gone through the misery of two world wars because of resource scarcity, by the way, that it was realized that somehow we have to break out of this cycle of misery, this cycle of poverty. We have to cheat, you know, if you want, nature, and outsmart nature. And the people who started the global depopulation policy have always had the best intentions. And I can imagine that at the beginning they also tried to implement it openly, that is, overtly through legislation. But that was not possible. And, of course, we discussed that in the last interview, why that was not possible. But to go back to what you said about the Japanese, it's interesting you mentioned the Japanese, because, yes, first of all, they, because of them living in a country that is completely overcrowded, they're expert at using space. You see that in their apartments and the way they furnish them. And now you mentioned an example in the way they grow, you know, food in every little space.
You see it in their technology. They've managed to compress everything down into the smallest size possible.
Yes. Also, another aspect that I want to mention about the Japanese, when I lived in British Columbia, that's on the west coast of Canada, and I was engaged to a young lady who was an English as a second language instructor, and who taught English to Japanese students. And we always had a Japanese student staying with us in our house over the summer, or even throughout the year. And one thing I've noticed, whenever we took the Japanese students on trips, you know, through the countryside or to see places, and of course British Columbia is absolutely stunningly beautiful. It's like New Zealand, just glorious nature, where, you know, it's a, they call it God's country. But the Japanese are so removed from nature, so divorced from nature. These children have never, you know, been in the countryside. They've always been in the big cities, surrounded by jungle. They had absolutely no interest in nature. They would fall asleep in the bus and miss all of that beautiful scenery. And I was just getting exasperatingly frustrated, you know, that they had absolutely no appreciation for the beauty of nature anymore. And this is the danger we have now as we raise, you know, new generations completely removed from nature inside these concrete jungles. They just have no conception and no appreciation for the beauty of nature and for the, you know, for the the biotopes that make life possible on this planet. And this is very, very dangerous development. Of course, you as a New Zealander probably cannot even fathom that. How can that be possible? Because you're surrounded by glorious nature.
No, and I'm not. I'm surrounded by an ever-expanding concrete jungle just like everywhere else in the world. I mean, everybody lives in a concrete jungle nowadays. I have seen the countryside. I have been to it and what have you, and I have seen it, and I do appreciate it. But at the end of the day, I spend 99% of my time surrounded by a tyrannical police state concrete jungle full of surveillance cameras and pollution, just like everybody else.
Nevertheless, as a New Zealander and as a Canadian, nature is never far away. It is within reach. But I spent 4 months in China in 2005, and I lived in Shanghai, which is, you know, a city of over 20 million people. And oftentimes we took trips to neighboring cities like Shenzhen and Suzhou, and we were looking forward to see the countryside in between. Of course, we would hop on the train, and the train would, you know, we'd go on a 2-hour, 3-hour train ride, but the city would never stop. The delineation between, you know, Suzhou or Hangzhou and the city of Shanghai was just not there. There was no countryside in between. The cities had grown to such an extent, these megalopolises had grown to such an extent that they had become one, you know, mega city that would stretch for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. And basically the entire seaboard of China is one big city. Even though it has, you know, different names, it is one continuous big city. Mm. Now, the Chinese really have no opportunity anymore. These children who grew up in these concrete jungles have no opportunity to even hope to see Mother Nature, you know, by going, you know, somewhere which is still pristine. There are no pristine places in China. Because the population is so huge, and the cities have become, you know, just glued together.
I would agree with you in terms of the urbanized areas, but I was talking with some people the other day. Who was it? I forget. But I was talking with my mother actually. My brother's married a Tahitian girl who's of Chinese descent. And they went to see their relatives in China, and they live in these rural areas where for hundreds of miles in every direction there is nothing, and they're still using buffaloes and carts to get around, and they live in huts with dirt floors. And so there is that section that still exists. It's kind of like what happens with urbanization is it's very much similar to the way digital technology works. When I was in university, I learned about this phenomenon called the digital divide, whereby one section of the population, i.e. Western culture, has digital technology, and so our culture advances that much faster than those who do not have access to digital technology. And I think it's a very similar phenomenon with those experiencing urbanization, but between those who do not, in fact, have access to that kind of technology within their little rural communities. It's kind of like pockets of humanity out there that are still doing things as they did 1,000 years ago, and nothing's changed.
Yes, absolutely. With higher population density and urbanization, you have to simply, because of the physical lack of space, you have to come up with inventive solutions, you know, to solve problems. You have to come up with, you know, all kinds of rules in order to coexist peacefully. Mm. Now, So you're forever. It's a forever an organic and a changing environment, and yes. This is why it promotes innovation.
It's like there's this innovation that we come up with cars, for example. One person said to me the other day, Vinny, I think we're trying to burn up too much technology. Would you rather we all be walking around with horse and cart and what have you? You can imagine how much horse manure would be on the streets if everybody was still on horseback.
And how many horses you would need?
Yeah.
We need 7 million horses. we don't even have enough land to grow, to raise cows or sheep.
We don't even have enough land to ride into the sunset.
But you mentioned that in China you still have, these rural places, and you do. And the reason you still have them and that are so, still so pristine, if you want, is because the Chinese government has gone out of its way to segregate, to separate the two populations, the urban and the rural. So they have this system called the hukou system, which prevents people from the countryside to move into the cities. So if you want to leave a village and move into the city, you become an illegal immigrant within your own country, within China. It's very, very difficult. And then you are deprived of access to schools for your children, of medical help, and so on. So the Chinese government has gone out of its way to prevent urbanization or to slow down urbanization, and even so, it has grown exponentially. But the hukou system still prevents a large segment of the Chinese population from moving into the cities, and that way the government can control the process of urbanization. And so that's why you still have these, these pockets of rural life that seem to be undisturbed in China, whereas you don't have them anywhere else. But to move back to go back to our list or short list of what has been averted, if I may return to the subject, may I?
Go for your life.
Okay, we've deviated. Now, another thing that they have saved us from that they have averted through the global depopulation policy is greater environmental degradation than we face today. Because had there been an extra 2 billion people that would have needed to be accommodated with food and land and housing, clothing and so on, sewage, yes. We would have had none of the protected tracts of land now that have been set aside as national parks and so on. We would have had to dip into these protected areas just to meet the immediate demand. And you see this problem continuously today in countries like Brazil, where there is continuous encroachment on the Amazon jungle. The slash and burn. People are just simply trying to make a living, so they're burning the forest, growing crops, and they're just eating into the Amazon forest little by little, and hundreds of thousands of hectares are disappearing every year. Now, imagine if we would have had to accommodate another 2 billion people. We would have had absolutely no tundra left, in Siberia. We would have had no taiga left in Siberia, no pristine forests in the Amazon, and even the Canadian forests would have all been gone. That is the reality of it. So the environmental degradation and devastation would have been far greater than it is today, and we would have been unable to save anything. We would have just resorted to desperate exploitation. And last but not least, there would have been no peace and prosperity in large parts of the world because we would have had to share share the same resources with an ever-growing population. And that would have eventually led to conflict, and that would have eventually led to nuclear war and nuclear annihilation. That much is certain. But what will happen if we continue, if the methods that are used today, these covert, biological, chemical, bacteriological methods are continuously used into the future, what will happen? Now, I try to, to think, crunch the numbers and to predict what will happen, given the results that we've experienced so far. And this is the short list I've come up with. 2 out of 4 women worldwide will be infertile by 2050, by the middle of the 21st century, and 3 out of 4 by the end of the 21st century, by 2100. 2 billion genetic lines will be terminated by 2050, and 4 billion by 2100, simply because they will no longer be able to procreate. Their genetic lines their ability to make children will be shut down, as we see already in the Western world, where in countries like Italy and Switzerland, one out of four women cannot have children or do not have children. And in countries like Canada, the United States, New Zealand, one out of five women cannot or do not have children. The IQ will be lowered from an average of circa 90 today to an average of 70 by 2050 and to an average of probably of 50 by 2100.
Oh my God.
Keep in mind that mental retardation starts around 50. An IQ of 50 is considered mentally retarded. Now, in the Western world, and we have an average IQ of about 90, 92, 93. Other countries, in African countries, apparently the IQ is lower. But that could very well be a function of, you know, how these tests are done. However, what is clear is that every generation subjected to chemical methods of population control, of which are fertility depressants, lose about 5 IQ points.
Fluoride does that.
Fluoride, yes, does that. And God knows what GMOs will do, because we have no experience with them, and we do not know. So we simply do not know the long-term effects of genetically modified...
Well, they have done studies on rodents and have determined that it takes 3 generations, I think, of mammals eating GMO food before they become completely sterilized.
Yes. Yes, and of course, my guess is that they can fiddle with the seeds, with GMO seeds, to cause sterilization within one generation, if that's what they want. However, this is not desirable, because they cannot hide the fact. Then, you know, if this is gradual, if it happens over multiple generations, then they can always say, well, this is the result of affluence, this is the result of environmental factors. You know, there's always an excuse for it.
So that's it's deception. It's deception for the greater good.
Yes.
And I always wondered this moral paradox. Is deception for the greater good at all? Can it possibly be? Had the population let's say, you know, you've got a problem in your family, like an addiction, or you have an intervention or something like that. It's because people are being honest with themselves, and then they go out and they solve said problem, because they now know and they now admit to themselves that said problem exists. Yeah. This is a way of solving a problem without anybody even realizing that there is a problem to solve, and in so doing, they lose their problem-solving's ability permanently.
You asked a philosophical question that goes to the core of this problem, and of course we can spend the next 2 days discussing that. Deception. The short answer to your question is deception is okay for a very short period of time when you just have no other alternative. Sooner or later, that catches up with you, and deception becomes, you know, a huge liability, because it results in complete disaster.
It has a snowballing effect, I've found. Yes. You know,
it's just like, you know, you lie once, then to cover up that one lie, you have to lie twice, and then your entire life, your entire system becomes one big lie, and that's exactly what we have now. Yeah. Our entire Western system has become one giant lie, and in order to protect this, you know, these truths, these inconvenient truths, we have this system of surveillance and censorship and control that is growing more and more intrusive and oppressive from year to year, because the lie has grown to such proportion that it is just bursting to explode. Truth has a way of wanting to surface, and it's bursting to surface. You know, you and I are, you know, the vehicles of the truth bursting to the surface. And of course, the authorities are trying to prevent this by all means necessary. But now they've realized that is no longer possible, one, and it is no longer desirable, two. Why? Because they know now. There is no more a doubt. There is no way of even lying to themselves that these methods do not cause, you know, tremendous damage to the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity. And if they continue, then we're going to end up annihilating ourselves.
Yes.
Well, to continue...
I would like to just make two quick statements there. I think the Mark Twain quotes. He said, if you don't lie, you don't have to have a very good memory. And and he also said it's far easier to convince somebody of a lie than it is to convince them that they've been lied to.
Yes, well, especially when the entire system is geared towards keeping the deception and promoting lies. And this is what we, you know, you and I, this is what we are breaking through. Where this is the matrix of control. This is what has become known as the matrix. And this matrix of control has this element of deception and lies. And it has come to this, you know, gradually, not because it was not intentional. It has come to this gradually because we have always chosen, you know, the lesser evil and the easiest way possible. And the easiest way possible is not always the best way possible, the best way. And that's the problem that we have in the West. You know, China, for instance, they've introduced the one-child policy, and that's it. Everything is in the open, right? Everybody respects the law or else...
they go to a forced labor camp.
Yes. So, you know, we've been blaming the Chinese and criticizing them, but with respect to how they address population, the population explosion, they're the only ones who have done it properly. And of course, we have a lot to learn from the Chinese. And my guess is that within the next 10 years or so, we will very much follow their model because there's no other way.
I was at a protest in Auckland once, and this Chinese lady came up to me and she said, "Well, what's going on here? What are all these people? What are all these people standing around here with signs and blaring through megaphones and what have you?" And I go, "It's a protest." And she goes, "What's a protest?" And I say, "You never seen one before, have you?" She lived in China, where every single protest results in everybody being arrested and killed.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't think we have a good... And that is a good lesson to learn from the Chinese. You know,
also, the reason Chinese society is so overregulated, so oppressive, is because they don't have the luxury of a lot of land and a lot of wealth to share. Everything there is stretched to the maximum. You know, they live in such close quarters with such few resources. They have to share and they have to, you know, to sort of respect each other's boundaries to such an extent that everything is completely overregulated, and the government is paranoid that if they lose control, everything can fall apart in no time at all. And this is one of the results. Yes, and this is one of the long-term results of overpopulation. Mm. If we had not addressed the population problem in covert ways, we would have had
a similarly oppressive state by now as well, wouldn't we?
We would have had even more so. Why? Because Westerners are far more aggressive individually. You know, we are far more. Throughout history, we've been far more aggressive. This is why we've expanded outward. You know, we've conquered other people's continents. We've taken away the land from others, and this is why
I think that was
all over the place.
I think that's actually because we could. We had we had the technology to oppress and conquer and enslave other people. And so we're just like, hey, I don't have to earn this. I don't have to be nice. I can just freaking take it. And I think this gave rise to the powerful domination of society by control freak psychopaths who are unable to be unseated from power without immense resistance from the host population. The problem is the host population have been manipulated so well by psychopaths who are adept at lying and lying believably that they think that we need these psychopathic control freaks to run our lives. And you were talking about China, and I recall a article in the Daily Mail, I believe. It was something along the lines of human battery farms in Hong Kong, these giant apartment structures where twice the size of a single bed is your apartment.
Yeah.
Literally. You're in a human battery farm. All of your cooking equipment and everything is in there. All of your clothing, all of your possessions, and your bed, and your everything is crammed into that. And it must be a terrible, horrific way to live.
I've lived in Hong Kong, and I've experienced that, you know, the closet-sized apartments. And this is what we would have all had to contend with had there been no interference with our fertility and had population growth continued naturally. Mm. So, you know, for better or worse, one of the benefits that we've drawn, you know, from population covert population control is that our affluence has been preserved and increased.
Indeed.
And, you know, we complain all we want, but had there not been these covert methods, we would have had no affluence whatsoever in the West. We would have been as poor as anybody else and as desperate as everybody else, living in closets just like in Hong Kong. And I tell you, it's not a pleasant thing. I lived in those closets in Hong Kong. I know what it is like.
Yeah.
A 500 square foot apartment in Hong Kong costs $500,000, the same as a mansion in Canada. You can buy a mansion in Canada for 5,000 square feet with the same amount of money as you would have to pay for a 500 square foot apartment. So 10 times less space in Hong Kong.
Wow. Okay, well, finish your point and then we're going to go to break.
Well, let me just go through the list quickly. I have a couple more. Do we have time?
We've got 2 more hours. So let's just take a break now, because I badly need to take a wiki leak. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with the amazing Kevin Galilee.